Yesterday, I stood at Arlington National Cemetery attending the funeral of a young Marine in my district. He believed in what we are doing is the right thing and had the courage to lay his life on the line to do it. A few minutes ago, I received a call from Colonel Danny Bupp, Ohio representative from the 88th District in the House of Representatives. He asked me to send Congress a message, stay the course. He also asked me to send Congressman Murtha a message that cowards cut and run, Marines never do. Danny and the rest of America and the world want the assurance from this body that we will see this through.
The House will be in order. 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 The gentlelady will suspend, and the clerk will report her words. All members will suspend. The gentleman from Arkansas has demanded that the gentlelady's words be taken down. The clerk will report the gentlelady's words. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The gentleman from Tennessee will take his seat. All members take seats. All members take seats. The gentleman from Massachusetts will cease and take his seat. All members will take their seats. All members take seats. The House will be in order. Members, please take seats. Gentlelady from Ohio.
Mr. Speaker, my remarks were not directed at any member of the House, and I did not intend to suggest that they applied to any member, most especially the distinguished gentleman from Pennsylvania. I therefore ask for unanimous consent that my words be withdrawn.
Without objection.
Reserving the right to object, Mr. Speaker.
Gentleman from Arkansas.
I appreciate the gentle lady's words, and I accept her.
Ohio, don't take back your words. Don't cut and run. Keep them. Because your house isn't in order after all, is it? Hey, so we don't complain in West Oakland. Business is great. Our head coffin business, that is. And you know our motto. As the number of G.I. Joes and Janes heads being blown and chopped off continues to grow, West Oakland Head Coffin Collective is where you need to go. Why buy a whole coffin when only your husband's, daughter's, son's head is left? Buy a little head coffin from us. Our head servicing department is the best. Our head coffins come in all colors with the best oak and maple wood on demand. We even started stuffing heads and mounting them like game trophies that you can put on your wall or nightstand. So you and a loved one, if you go into Iraq, let us know and measure that head beforehand so you can have a customized head coffin built instead of one pulled off our rack. We aim to please in your business we adore, because after what you've done to our sisters and brothers in New Orleans, slave revolt in Oakland declares war, and I mean that. You know what time it is. Slave time. Listening to 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org, SKID, 107.5 North Carolina, Upstart Radio, LUVER.com, The World, RadioForAll.net, The Universe, check out the Slave Web. Just go Slave Revolt Radio in your Google. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to delve into how the ruins of this empire are playing itself out. And an update on what's happening to our sisters and brothers in New Orleans. You know what time it is on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
You know what time it is. Ruins of Empire. And tonight, you know, as the cracks in the U.S. military machine are widening, as the elites in the air and their administrators bicker amongst themselves on what imperial course to take next, much of the American population is still in some form of hallucinatory trance. But the bullets being shot into the behinds of their boys and girls are shaking them and their imperial elected officials into reality. Tonight, on this, Ruins of Empire segment, we're going to deal with what's going on in a segment called Cut and Run or Stay and Die. So let's start off with the imperial elected official for the ruling order, Democrat John Murtha, you know, military man, Marine. Made a big name for himself in the Marines, killing up Vietnamese, you know, during the Vietnam War. This tough guy, Hawk, has now been pushed into another reality. And here, let's explore how he's pushing, in essence, also a panic button. So let's explore what this all really means. So check this out.
I started out by saying the war in Iraq is not going as advertised. It's a flawed policy wrapped in illusion. The American public is way ahead of the members of Congress. The United States and coalition troops have done all they can in Iraq. But it's time for a change in direction. Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America, the Iraqi people, or the Persian Gulf region. General Casey said in September 2005 hearing, the perception of occupation in Iraq is a major driving force behind the insurgency. General Abaze said on the same date, reducing the size and visibility of the coalition forces in Iraq is a part of our counterinsurgency strategy. For 2.5 years, I've been concerned about U.S. policy and the plan in Iraq. I've addressed my concerns with the administration and the Pentagon, and I've spoken out in public about my concerns. The main reason for going to war has been discredited. A few days before the start of the war, I was in Kuwait. The military drew a line, a red line, around Baghdad. And they said, when U.S. forces cross that line, they will be attacked by the Iraqis with weapons of mass destruction. And I believed it, and they believed it. But the U.S. forces, the commander said, they were prepared. They said they had well-trained forces with the appropriate protective gear. Now, let me tell you, we spent more money on intelligence than all the countries in the world put together, and more on intelligence than most countries' GDP. And when they say it's a world intelligence failure, it's a U.S. intelligence failure. It's a U.S. failure, and it's a failure in the way the intelligence was used.
So basically, as when you hear a Murtaugh talking, none of this stuff would really be a big deal if the imperial process had went to game plan. In other words, with all of the Iraqis that are slaughtered, let that be the case and more. But if the U.S. was not, military was not in the quagmire that it finds itself in, all of these issues now that are ripe and are now smashing back into the face of Boy George and company wouldn't be an issue. So the fact that they lied their way into the war is not really that much different than the way Boy George's father lied himself into the war with the incubator stories and all of these things that were proven to be out and out falsifications. But the thing is that they had the concession of Saddam's forces fairly quickly. There wasn't a large casualty rate, and there was a quick end to the overall conflict. So even though the same type of deceitful game, the same type of manipulation of the media, and the same type of acquiescence and collaboration of the corporate media to the policies of the empire overall, even though that took place in the first Gulf War, since there was quick victory for the imperialist forces, it was basically all good. So now when we hear Murtaugh talking about these issues, what really burns out is the fact that Iraq is resisting. And once you and your policies do not complete its mission in the way that the ruling order wants it, then you can often get left up on the frying pan. And that's what is starting to happen. So it's not the shameless lies and deceptions and manipulation that has gotten Boy George and company in fire. It's just that their imperial efforts have not come to fruition. And this helps set the stage for the Murtaughs and other rats who are now jumping out of the sinking ship. But here Murtaugh goes into the mindset he observed of many U.S. G.I. Joes and James. So check it out.
I've been visiting our wounded troops of Bethesda and Walter Reed, as some of you know, almost every week since the beginning of the war. And what demoralizes them is not the criticism. What demoralizes them is going to war with not enough troops and equipment to make the transition to peace. The devastation caused by IEDs is what they're concerned about. Being deployed to Iraq when their homes have been ravaged by hurricanes, and you've seen these stories about some of the people whose homes were destroyed and they were deployed to Iraq afterward. Being on their second or third deployment, leaving their families behind without a network of support. The threat by terrorism is real. But we have other threats that cannot be ignored. We must prepare to face all these threats. The future of our military is at risk. Our military and our families are stretched thin. Many say the Army's broken. Some of our troops are on a third deployment. Recruitment is down, even as the military has lowered its standards. They expect to take 20% Category 4, which is the lowest category, which they said they'd never take. And they've been forced to do that to try to meet a reduced quota. Defense budgets are being cut. Personnel costs are skyrocketing, particularly in health care. Choices will have to be made. We cannot allow promises we have made to our military families in terms of service benefits, in terms of their health care, to be negotiated away. Procurement programs that ensure our military dominance cannot be negotiated away. We must be prepared. The war in Iraq has caused huge shortfalls in our bases at home. I've been to three bases in the United States, and each one of them was short of things they need to train the people going to Iraq. Much of our ground equipment is worn out, and I've told the CEOs of the big companies, you better get in the business of rehabilitating equipment, because we're not going to be able to buy any new equipment because the money's not going to be there. George Washington said to be prepared for war is one of the most effective means of preserving peace. We don't want somebody to miscalculate down the road. It takes us 18 years to put a weapon system in the arsenal. And I don't know what the threat is. Nobody knows what the threat is. But we better make sure we have what's necessary to preserve our peace. We must rebuild our army. Our deficit is growing out of control. The director of the Congressional Budget Office recently admitted to being terrified about the deficit in the coming decades. In other words, where's the money going to come from for defense? I voted against every tax cut. Every tax cut I voted against. My wife says you shouldn't say that. I believe that when we voted for these tax cuts, you can't have a war, and you can't have a tragedy like we had the hurricanes, and then not have a huge deficit, which is going to increase interest rates and could cause real problems. This is the first prolonged war we've ever fought with 3 years of tax cuts, without full mobilization of American industry, and without a draft. And the college campus always asked me about a draft. You for a draft? Actually, there's only two of us voted for it, so you don't have to worry too much about it. The burden of this war has not been shared equally. The military and their families are shouldering the burden. Our military has been fighting this war in Iraq for over 2.5 years. Our military has accomplished its mission and done its duty. Our military captured Saddam Hussein, captured or killed his closest associates. But the war continues to intensify. Deaths and injuries are growing. And over 2,079 confirmed American deaths, over 15,500 have been seriously injured. Half of them returned to duty. And it's estimated over 50,000 will suffer from what I call battle fatigue. And there have been reports at least 30,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed.
All right, so once again, you can see, Murtaugh's basically a super hawk. He's not really talking anything that's anti-imperialist. I know many slob Democrats are trying to look at this and spin it, these liberal types, as this is a tide changing. It's not a tide changing within the structure of the way the empire works, how the order thinks or anything, because they're locked into this whole mechanism. It's just that there are enough, let's say, rational imperialists. Now, I know that's a play on words, but from their vantage point, you know, Murtaugh and them are basically coming at it from a rational imperialist standpoint. where they're saying, look, you guys are demoralizing all forces, including our military forces. You know, in other words, Boy George and company have been basically treating the U.S. Military forces in the same way that they treat the U.S. workers, you know, stealing their pension and all of that. Now, of course, it's much easier to do that, at least at this time, to the workers, because many of the workers, you don't need, many of the workers in America, you're outsourcing their jobs, they find themselves easily replaceable, etc., etc. But when you have an Imperial Petroleum Guard force out there for the U.S. Order's interests and stuff, if you mess around and demoralize them, especially when it's not really that large of numbers that they are really operating in, if you take the total population of the United States, then that can have a disastrous effect. So the fact that you have situations where, you know, like the IED devastation, well, a lot of that, especially earlier, was linked to all those cheap trucks and how they didn't, you know, Bush and them didn't supply them with the right protection in the armored vehicles. And you got had guys scrapping off metal and welding it to the vehicles themselves because Bush and them were so cavalier about it. That plays a demoralizing effect in the long run, where even the most patriotic Yahoo knows that the elite order doesn't really give a damn about them, and their administrators in office, public office, don't care about them. So at the same time, they see the cash cows that Halliburton and all of them are getting, you know, and you know, reading about how billions of dollars go missing here and there, you know. So when this type of stuff goes on, it makes it clear that they're just being used as disposable entities, just basically to help fulfill the coffers and the grand chessboard strategies of an elite class. And it's one thing to do that to, you know, a gumpified population like this, if the various missions go pretty smoothly overall, Panama, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But if all of a sudden there's a quagmire type of situation, then that could bring up and has brought up a lot of the intensified issues that you see taking place. And in a society like this, where the elite class is just so busy ripping off the masses of people at every step, you know, Hurricane Sam happens, they just rip it off and make it a boondoggle for themselves and stuff. At the same time, they're stripping as much money from the public as possible. They're stripping laws so that pharmaceutical companies and everyone else can pulverize the population with whatever junk they want to put out there without any repercussions. So they're so drunk off of that aspect that now they're faced with an entity in Iraq that's not cooperating like many other entities have been. And their leverage, especially with what's going on in South America, which is actually the most positive resistance towards American empire happening anywhere on the planet at this time, things are just spiraling out of control. And those who are the lead administrators for the ruling order at that particular time, and in this case it's the Republican Party, they're the ones, you know, quote-unquote officially steering the vessel and stuff, they're the ones who are going to have to take the brunt of the criticism. But this is not criticism of how the whole machine is set up. It's just that some of the operators, the administrators for the machine at this particular time, are being brought to question. So when you have a military like this, reduce yourself down to category 4 of, you know, of the types of recruits that it will take in. Once again, this shows how much trouble they are trying to have people to be willing cannon fathers for a machine where they know they're only going to get grinded up in. It's not like these little, you know, weak commercials where you see someone climbing up a mountain in between a football game, gets to the top of the mountain, flicks his heels with a little sword, and all of a sudden he's a Marine, you know, all that junk. Now his head's rolling down the mountain. That's what the reality that's setting in now. And Murta is basically trying to steer the imperial machine into a more rational imperialist strategy. In other words, it's still the same barbarity. It's just saying, look, where we set sails on this particular course has crashed into some rocks, and we need to steer it out of the rocks, repair the boat, and take another course of our imperialist mission. Now here, Murta goes into the report on the whole Andar province in Iraq. So let's see and hear more of his concerns about how you can basically cut and run or stay and die.
I just recently visited Anbar province in Iraq in order to assess the conditions on the ground. And last May, we put in the emergency supplemental spending bill, Moran Amendment, which was accepted in conference, which required the Secretary of Defense to submit a quarterly report about the inaccurately measured stability and security in Iraq. Now we've now received two reports. So I just came back from Iraq and I looked at the next report. I'm disturbed by the findings in the key indicator areas. Oil production and energy production are below pre-war level. You remember they said that was going to pay for the war. And it's below pre-war level. Our reconstruction efforts have been crippled by the security situation. Only $9 billion of $18 billion appropriated for reconstruction has been spent. And I said on the floor of the House, when they passed the $87 billion, the $18 billion is the most important part of it. Because you got to get people back to work. You got to get electricity. You got to get water. Unemployment is 60%. Now, they tell you in the United States it's less than that. So it may be 40%. But in Iraq, they told me it's 60% when I was there. Clean water is scarce, and they only spent $500 million of the $2.2 billion appropriated for water project. And most importantly, this is the most important point, incidents have increased from 150 a week to over 700 in the last year. Instead of attacks going down over a time when we had additional more troops, attacks have grown dramatically. Since the revolution of the Blue Grab, American casualties have doubled. You look at the timeline, you'll see one per day average before a Blue Grab. After a Blue Grab, you'll see two a day. Two killed per day because of the dramatic impact that a Blue Grab had on what we were doing in there. And the State Department reported in 2004, right before they quit putting reports out, that they indicate a sharp increase in global terrorism. I said over a year ago, now, the military administration agrees now that Iraq cannot be won militarily. I said 2 years ago, the key to progress in Iraq is Iraqitize, internationalize, and energize. We have a packet for you where I sent a letter to the President in September, and I got an answer back from Assistant Secretary of Defense 5 months later. I believe the same today. They don't want input. They only want to criticize. Bush 1 was the opposite. Bush 1 might not like the criticism and constructive suggestions, but he listened to what we had to say. I believe that, and I have concluded, the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq is impeding this progress. Our troops have become the primary target of the insurgency. They are united against U.S. forces We have become a catalyst for violence. U.S. troops are the common enemy of the Sunnis, the Saddamists, and the foreign jihadists. And let me tell you, they haven't captured any of this latest activity, so this idea that they're coming in from outside, we still think there's only 7%. I believe with the U.S. troop redeployment, the Iraqi security forces will be incentivized to take control. A poll recently conducted, this is a British poll, reported in the Washington Times, over 80% of Iraqis are strongly opposed to the presence of coalition forces. And about 45% of the Iraqi population believe attacks against American troops are justified. I believe we need to turn Iraq over to the Iraqis. I believe before the Iraqi elections, scheduled for mid-December, the Iraqi people and the emerging government must be put on notice. The United States will immediately redeploy. Immediately redeploy. No schedule which can be changed. Nothing that's controlled by the Iraqis. This is an immediate redeployment of our American forces because they have become the target.
All right, so once again, this is a sound of desperation. These are crumblings within the empire on various levels, and in the Iraqi case, on a military, economic, and grand chessboard strategic level. Now, if you check out some of our early shows, you know, right when the war was starting, and after they had started the occupation, after they broke into Baghdad, how it was clear that, you know, see, it's easy to break into the country when you have the type of overwhelming force and air power and all of that. The issue is the occupation. But of course, remember Boy George, Cheney, Rumsfeld, they were all hooping it up back then as if that symbolized complete victory. And all of these symbolic acts, like, you know, ripping down Saddam's statue and all of that, were supposed to take or put the victory in the final threshold. Remember, Boy George walking on that little aircraft carrier with his little jumpsuit on, you know, pretending that he's some kind of fighting Navy pilot. All this facade and stuff. But at the end of the day, you got to bring it on down to Soulsville. And on the soil is where this is really playing itself out. Now, I constantly was talking about how if these imperialist forces were not so fortunately drunk with power, they would have tried to buy off larger segments of the Iraqi population by opening up the schools really quick again, not having the corporations be so silly and ripping off the population, not having people wait 10 to 12 hours in line for a cup of gas when they know right under their feet is one of the largest petroleum reserves in the world, have water come back on and fixed immediately, put large segments of the working class and youth population to work, rebuilding their own country and stuff, so you can keep a lot of the youth employed and so on and so forth. That's how more, at least in the past, typically educated and intellectual imperialists would have done it. But fortunately, they didn't do it like that. Fortunately, once again, they're so drunk with power that they just said, to hell with all y'all guys' concerns. We're just going to do what we're going to do. And now, as Murtagh is relating, the oil production and energy production is below pre-war levels. So, when Saddam was in power, they had better production, energy-wise and oil-wise. They've only spent $9 billion of the $18 billion on the refurbishment aspect, unemployment up to at least 60%, and clean water scarcity. Now, this helps, once again, highlight how they helped mold the resistance, how they helped create and intensify the situation. Because once again, they're so drunk with power. Now, all of these guys are imperialists. It's just that what the criticism that's really being fired at Boy George and Company is how reckless their imperialist strategy was, how arrogant and stuff. So, and as he mentioned, how the American casualties doubled after the Abu Ghraib situation. Now, once again, this has him mentioning that has nothing to do, or the concern about Abu Ghraib has nothing to do with the barbarity of the American G.I. Joes and Janes towards the Iraqi people. They've done this stuff all over the world. They have School of the Americas and their trainees doing these types of stuff throughout the planet. In Panama, as the video School of the Assassins outlined, after these guys got trained at the School of the Americas, they would practice on homeless people various torturing things if they didn't have, the right suspects or whoever to practice on. This is how sick and cynical. The CIA manuals right within the School of the Americas, as I talk about in my commentary, the School of the Americas is a school straight out of hell, had right within it the documentation on the teachings of torture that were taught to students and is taught to students at the SOA. So Murtha and them, they've known about all of this. All of these Democrats have known all about this. These raggedy Republicans and other people have known about this. The problem now is that now there's a price to pay, and it's being paid for this type of barbarity. Look, John Birch right now is in the little typical political within the quote-unquote American justice system version of trouble. In other words, John Birch, the torturer of countless, you know, black and Latinos in Chicago, of Aaron Patterson and the others, has now found himself in court over the torture that he has done to these guys, especially throughout the 80s and 90s. Now, they sent him off to retire as a little cat fisherman in Florida, so it wasn't like, you know, he was any real punishment. But through the efforts of cats like Aaron Patterson and Fred Hampton Jr., he's been brought back for a trial and stuff. Now, there's no real concern amongst the average citizen in America, progressive, conservative, administrator for the ruling order, police, or anything about the John Bird situation, because, to be quite frank, their heads are not literally rolling off as a result of this institutionalized savagery towards black and Latino people, like there are heads being chopped off in Iraq for their institutionalized savagery against the Iraqis. In other words, what makes them take notice is not the savagery that they commit, but the price they have to pay for their savagery. That's what this is all about. They are paying a price for their imperialism, for their arrogance, for their brutality, for their savagery. Now next, Murtha goes into the redeployment plan and goes into, some of the, why he's personally moved by some of these issues and people. Of course, they're USGI Joe people. Check it out.
Iraq must know that Iraq is free from a United States occupation. And I believe this will send a signal to the Sunnis to join the political process. My experience in the guerrilla war says that until you find out where they are, until the public is willing to tell you where the insurgent is, you're not going to win this war. And Vietnam was the same way. If you have an operation military operation. And you tell the Sunnis, because the families are in jeopardy, you tell the Iraqis that they are going to tell the insurgents because they're worried about their families. My plan calls for immediate redeployment of U.S. troops consistent with the safety of the U.S. forces, to create a quick reaction force in the region, to create an over-the-horizon presence of Marines, and to diplomatically pursue security and stability in Iraq. Now, let me personalize this thing for you. I go out to the hospitals every week. One of my first visits, two young women, one was 22 or 23, had two children, lost her husband. One was 19. And they both went out to the hospitals to tell the people out there how happy they were, or how happy they should be to be alive. In other words, they were reaching out because they felt their husbands had done their duty, but they wanted to tell them that they were so fortunate, even though they're wounded, to be alive. I have a young fellow in my district who was blinded and he lost his foot. They did everything they could for him at Walter Reed. Then they sent him home. His father was in jail. He had nobody at home. Imagine this. A young kid that age, 22, 23 years old, goes home to nobody. VA did everything they could do to help him. He was reaching out. So they sent him, to make sure that he was blind, they sent him to John Hopkins. John Hopkins started sending bills. Then the collection agency started sending bills. Well, when I found out about it, you can imagine they stopped the collection agency and Walter Reed finally paid the bills. But imagine a young person being blinded without a foot. He's getting bills from a collection agency. I saw a young soldier who lost two legs and an arm, and his dad was pushing him around. I go to the mental ward. You know what they say to me? I got battle fatigue. You know what they say? We don't get nothing. We get nothing. We're just as bruised, just as injured as everybody else, but we don't even get a Purple Heart. We get nothing. We get shunted aside. We get looked at as if there's something wrong with us. Saw a young woman from Notre Dame. Basketball player, right-handed, lost her right hand. You know what she's worried about? She's worried about her husband because he lost weight worrying about her. These are great people. These soldiers and people are serving. They're marvelous people.
So once again, this is the goes into some of the aspects of how those within this administration and those within the ruling order are so drunk with their short-term reign and superpowerness that the true reflection of them is being brightly shown. They're not even trying to cloak themselves in some of the typical shadows that they usually do. So here you have someone who's blinded, lost a foot, father in jail, alone, sent to John Hopkins Hospital to check out his eyes and stuff. Then he starts getting bills from John Hopkins and then the collection agency. They don't care. You're disposable. But see, this is all what I've been predicting in the earlier series concerning this whole aspect of how this imperial war is going to play out. And as long as you continue to be to put on those cowboy boots, you know, be a Christopher Columbus with cowboy boots on, you get what you get. And I have no problem with it. Turn your guns against the beast apparatus, and then we can talk. But align yourself with a machine that has the same type of disregard for the people all throughout the world that is showing towards you. Well, if you're a fighter for that machine and you're carrying out those missions for the machine, then you can't expect anyone of right mind to have any sympathy for you. Now, once again, all Murta is really talking about is a reassessment and restructuring, or a tactical re-maneuvering of how to operate in this particular setting that they're in. He's not talking about dismantlement of all these bases that they are setting up in Iraq. He's not talking about giving control over, giving the control of the masses of resources over to the Iraqi people. No, he's not. Nah. Is that this particular strategy carried out by this particular administration in the way it did, with not having a large force go in and be on the ground? Recall, once again, many generals were saying that they need at least 300,000 to 400,000 boots on the ground for the control during the occupation period. But it was Rumsfeld and all of those guys who were bantering out this shock and awe type of stuff, and that once they shocked and awed the population into submission, the rest would just be cheering for them as they came galloping in. And that would more or less end the resistance right there. It was all smoke and mirrors. They look like the same clown that they were making fun of, who was, like Saddam's cheerleading spokesman, who would say, "We have the imperialist forces at bay." You know, remember him, where he would come out and talk about how good the resistance was going against the imperial forces. And at the same time, the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. They had a good laugh about him then. But now, as one looks, the laugh is really now on them, because all that smack that they were talking is collapsing before their eyes. And now, being the rats that they are, they're trying to jump out of one burning ship and paddle to safety onto another ship and try another maneuver. Now, Murta, he's just another slime ball. When he talks about the Iraqis must know they're free, we all know freedom does not mean freedom when it comes out of the behind of an administrator for the imperialist forces, for the masses of people. So the reality is that they must cut and run, or stay and die. And they are going to stay and die, because there's a whole lot more at stake. But to show the type of internal fighting that's similar to the internal fighting that went on during Vietnam, once again, making up excuses to get in there, the Gulf of Tonkin distortion, lie, to get into the Vietnam War, the techniques of rewriting the story and history and making up demons in a collective guilt way and pinpointing it on one particular or a couple of figureheads, all of that type of stuff to get in there. But at the end of the day, when the Vietnamese kept putting bullets in that ass, that was the turning point. Now, of course, Boy George and them are going to try to strike back. So here's Boy George talking about the unpatriotics, or are people unpatriotic who criticize the war and debate and stuff like that. And this is followed by, I got five on it, Cheney. You know, meaning five deferments from the Vietnam War itself. So let's check these guys out.
The article of expertise agree with the president, bottom. What bothers me is when people are irresponsibly using their positions and playing politics.
The president and I cannot prevent certain politicians from losing their memory or their backbone. But we're not going to sit by and let them rewrite history.
Now that's kind of incredible hearing. It's a shameless hearing Cheney talk about someone losing their backbone. Mr. I got five on it, Dick Cheney. Five deferments. When it was his time to go out and show how much heart he had, he cut and ran. Like the punk he is. And we don't even need to get into Boy George, old crackhead boy. I mean, this, you know. So, once again, when he's talking about we're not going to sit by and let them rewrite history, it's not really rewriting of history. It's rats jumping off a burning ship, even though they helped steer it into this inferno, which is why elements are attacking them. They're not attacking them because of imperialism. They're attacking them because of a failed imperialist strategy. Now, since there's an opening for the administrators for the ruling order to debate this issue now, because of the quagmire, these mad imperialist criminals have gotten themselves in. Once again, Marta shoots back at Cheney, which of course isn't all that hard because, you know, Cheney wouldn't know an M16 from a squirt gun.
I like guys who got five deferments and never been there and send people to war and then don't like to hear suggestions about what need to be done.
So they're just talking smack back to themselves because basically you have a situation where this failed strategy is something that there's a price to be paid for. And you now have, Hagel. He's from Nebraska. You know, he's a Republican. He's talking about drawdown. You had, of course, the cynical ploy by the Republicans about, you know, pull out immediately, even though they knew it wasn't going to pass and stuff like that. And comments about how it's puzzling that Marta, as, you know, great of a quote-unquote imperialist career he's had, he now is endorsing the same policy as Michael Moore and so on and so forth. But see, these are just basically posturing shots because Marta and the rest of them would not have any, what they are saying would not have the type of soundbite attraction in the corporate media structure and would not be resonating within the various halls of Congress, etc., if the quagmire did not exist. So these guys are still all beasts, but they're beasts that have gotten themselves in trouble. And now those who are steering the helm find themselves on the hot seat, so to speak. Now, to show how slimy this really is, though, here's John, They Misled Us, Kerry, on MSNBC Hardball with Chris Matthews. So, they always mislead Kerry, right? Check this out.
They misled us with respect to the planning, misled us with respect to the numbers of allies that would be involved, misled us with respect to the inspections. This is where, frankly, the president, the vice president, and his supporters distort this issue. They try to say to America, Democrats want to just cut and run. No, we don't. We want to succeed. And we believe we have a better plan for success. And it was...
likelihood the most feared of the subtext to the start of the war in Iraq, chemical weapons, or by the third day or fourth day, as analysts assume they awaited American troops in every Iraqi city, they were simply known as chem. It proves there were indeed chemical weapons in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, and they were ours. Pentagon correspondent Jim Mikulski now on the highly flammable and passion-inflaming compounds called white phosphorus.
The accusations first aired by Italian television claimed the U.S. military used chemical weapons, specifically incendiary white phosphorus munitions, against Iraqi civilians during the battle for Fallujah 1 year ago. Though the U.S. ordered civilians to leave Fallujah before the offensive, an estimated 40,000 remained in the densely packed city. The documentary showed images of badly burned bodies it claimed were civilians who had been attacked and killed by the fiery weapons.
So once again, this is just basically a breakdown. This is MSNBC going into the aspect of them using chemical weapons in Fallujah, the white phosphorus and stuff. You know, you can check out that documentary on the Indie Media website. They have it up there. And by the Italian cats who did the documentary. And of course, at first they were denying it, and then of course now they admit it, and now it's gotten legs and stuff. But the legs is basically based off of the fact that this administration finds itself in a particular quagmire. So once again, it's the bullets in the ass, the resistance, that is breaking down the whole apparatus and stuff. It's not that these guys have not been exposed as liars before or leading up. We've known about the Downing Street memos and all of that type of stuff, but they were holding course well before then and all throughout that period. But now it's hit a point where it's so obvious that there's no real end in sight for the imperialist forces in their occupation quest, that the situation in Iraq is now raising many concerns amongst the various operating forces in Iraq and in the U.S. over Iraq, because of the quagmire that Sam has found himself in, from a military standpoint, an economic standpoint, a political standpoint, on down the road, and for geopolitical control and stuff, because the competitors, this the imperial and capitalist competitors, are just basically standing back and licking their chops. In Australia, they recently talked about how they're going to double their size of their navy because they see this as the dawn of the U.S. empire, and that they're going to have to go out and fight their own fights now because the U.S. won't be in position to do this. So they're going to have to do it for themselves. This is not missed upon many of the various administrators for the ruling order who want to maintain the U.S. being the dominant player. So all of this helps open up more and more criticism that one normally would not see. But it's not an indictment on the system that they're really going after. It's just basically they are basically going after the particular tactics that the current administrators use. Now, you know, it's real cynical also when you see someone like Cheney make his comments about Murtha, and then, you know, you heard Murtha make that comment about five deferments, because Cheney, when Cheney was put into office as Secretary of Defense back in the George Bush the first term, he ran to Murtha you know, the little Pennsylvania Democrat, and said to him, I'm going to need a lot of help. I don't know a blankety-blank thing about defense. And Murtaugh basically backed him and stuff, and they were real close. Murtaugh's always been a hawk. He supported Ronald Decrypt Reagan's policies in El Salvador and Nicaragua. And we know those death policies and forms of international terrorism and stuff. So now Cheney going after Murtaugh because Murtaugh is basically a concern about the course that the imperial imperial administrators are leading the this imperial quest on. This shows how sour and slimy this whole situation is and how corrupt they all are. Now, to top it off on this particular segment of Cut and Run or Stay and Die, to show how shameless these guys are and how they really like to rewrite history right before our eyes, we all know Donald Rumsfeld was one of the biggest smack talkers in the early and stages of the war and preceding the beginning of the war. The terms like shock and awe, him standing by these generals talking smack, smirking in front of the press and all of that type of stuff about what they were going to do to Saddam and what they were going to do to the insurgents and how the insurgents didn't have that much longer to last, etc., etc. Well, on this week with George Stephanopoulos, this is while Boy George himself is out bike riding with the Chinese Olympic mountain bike team. This is what old Rumsfeld had to say to Stephanopoulos about his feelings about the invasion. Check this out.
Is it correct to suggest that General Vines or General Casey or General Evers have ever asked for more troops and been turned down? That is flat not true.
You know, what has been happening as we debate the number of troops, as we debate whether to withdraw, is also this continual debate over the intelligence leading up to the war. And I know you said you believe that it's wrong to question the motives or the honesty of administration officials, but I have a different question for you. If you had known that no weapons of mass destruction would be found, would you have advocated invasion?
I didn't advocate invasion.
You didn't?
No, I wasn't asked. If you read all the books and the things...
You were, but why weren't you asked? That's very puzzling.
Well, I'm sure the president understood what my views were, but as a technical matter, did he ever look and say, what should we do? Should we go do this or not do that? This is something that the president thought through very carefully.
Are you trying to distance yourself
from the
war with that?
Of course not. I agree completely with the decision to go to war. And said that 100 times. And don't even suggest that.
I'm just asking.
Yeah, well, you know better.
Now that takes the cake right there. Rumsfeld is now trying to pretend that he didn't advocate going to war. This exposes the crisis that they're in right there. When Rumsfeld, I mean, we did a whole thing called Rumsfeld's Follies and had to cover the fool constantly proceeding up to the Imperial Invasion and during the Imperial Invasion in the beginning of the stages, especially because of, how much smack and how ruthlessly he was advocating for this imperial invasion. This is also part of the reason why I would cover these guys so closely on these various talk shows and things like that. Not for my own health or anything like that, but to help show how the mechanism works so that when they do get in crisis or things turn and stuff like that, just how cynical they are and how much they expect you to have some kind of fleeting memory. This is part of the Gumpification process. Now, you know, when the American Airlines Flight 77 smashed into the Pentagon, it was Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. right then telling his aides to come up with plans for a strike against Iraq, even though, as we all know, there was no links to a Saddam Hussein. And what has later come out also, at when Rumsfeld was ordering military plans to begin working on the various attacks, in one of his aides' notes, it said at 2:40 p.m., the notes quote Rumsfeld as saying he wanted, quote, best be fast, judge whether good enough, hit SH, meaning Saddam Hussein. At same time, not only UBL, meaning Osama bin Laden, go massive, the notes quote him as saying, sweep it all up, things related and not. So right from the beginning, or before the beginning, as we all know, how they had plans with the whole project, the New American Century, and how, of course, Big Oil had plans through their jackal-type techniques and stuff that was being mainly mouthed through the State Department, especially during crime Bill Clinton's administration, when they were trying to destabilize Saddam Hussein and Iraqi society by all of their particular, you know, no-fly zones, getting Saddam assassin, terrorism bombings internally inside the country, etc., etc. But Rumsfeld had always been a part of that. But once again, here's a situation where these guys find themselves in a quagmire and being the cowards that they really are. They're true cowards. They don't hold on. They don't stay the course. They cut and run. Well, it's time that they are cut and run out of existence. Because this type of hypocrisy, when they're not even in harm's way, at least not for, not right now, shows how cowardly and pathetic they really are. Hold on a sec.
Everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong. You see, wherever they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets.
in occupied New Orleans rages on. Simpletons, you know, and these sleeping vote media leaders like Jesse Jackson have no real strategy or freedom for what our people face. Sister named Keyshawn Harris, 20 years old, mother of one, is going through what many of our people in New Orleans find themselves going through under this savage system. As she's resisting forced eviction in the Lewisburg Square in New Orleans. So we're going to step in beyond the shadows and take another look and analysis of what's going on with our folks down in New Orleans in this segment called New Orleans, the Classroom for Black America. So first off, let's check out what Keyshawn has to say. Check it out.
Well, I noticed it when I came back into town on Saturday morning, and it was in, like, the area of the doorknob in my door. The notice said that I have to appear in court on the 15th of November, on the 14th of November. I mean, no, let's see, what is it? The 15th of November on Tuesday for 10 a.m. Came back on last month to retrieve my property and everything and see what's going on with the apartment. The lady told me that I could not pay any rent and I could not stay there, so therefore I don't stay there at all. I come in and out to check on my property and get different things that me and my baby need from time to time, and so I could find me somewhere else to go. Like I said, once the lady told me I can't pay rent, I can't live there or anything, that we would have to move. I guess they want us out. They say they wanted us out because they want to remodel the whole. But I think if, you know, my apartment and everyone else's apartment is livable, maybe that we can pay our rent and still resign in the apartment. And when the other ones are finished, then they can move us over to another one. But I guess they want us out because they want to remodel everything and they also want to go up on the rent. Like right now, when I went to apartment on yesterday, we don't have any lights. And I see them laughing and everything, like we got them now, as if they did something to force us to move out of the complex, even though other residents have started paying their rent and everything. I'm a certified nursing assistant, and I work for a seating company, and I also work for a nursing home in Kenner. From time to time, I work 8 hours to 12 hours, but most time I don't really get any sleep because I'm in between both schedules. Like, at night I work from 6:45 to 7 a.m. this morning, and I had to come to court on this morning. I had to go back to work for 2 to 10, and then I had to go back to the other job from 4 to 7, so I float in between. I really need to sleep because I know I have to find a better living for me and my child, and I have to get an income or something. Right now, he's with my sister because I didn't have anyone to watch him, any child care provider, and we don't really have anywhere stable to stay because they said we can't live in an apartment. Well, for Thanksgiving, I'm gonna take off so I could go out there and I could see him, and I'm back like within 1 or 2 days because I'm back to start working again. Just made a birthday, he just made 3. Right now, I'm paying $385 a month. Money that we do get and we do have, I have to spend on food and transportation and other things because I lost my car in the storm, and I also, you know, I'm losing my house now. People have all type of tricks up their sleeves, and they're trying their best to get us out of there to their best ability. But I hope it work out for the best.
This shows you how sick these landlords are and these other merchants of death. They tell this sister that she can't pay rent. Don't pay rent. Even though she has the money, they tell her don't pay rent and you can't stay there, even though the property is not damaged. And even though she has a lease on the property that has not expired. So they're just using this as an excuse. This is like, as we've gone over before, this is why I've been calling it Hurricane Sam. These are all the elements of how the savages within this society use to exploit you know who. And it's just a non-stop situation. So here you have a situation where rent is going up in the region because they have the black population pulverized and spread out. So now, all of a sudden, it's prime real estate. And the affordability is getting less. And less affordable for moderate and poor income people. And people who work there, like her in the region, she doesn't want to lose her job and, you know, take her chances out someplace else. And plus, that's where she's from. They don't care about anyone's roots. They just use it to exploit people. They just use their various mechanisms within this order to exploit people. And the state, since it's doing it themselves, because that's how it's set up to, and it's doing it on a larger level with the whole, you know, Halliburton and contracts and stuff like that, in alignment with what FEMA and Red Cross and Negro Nagin and all of them are doing, Old Line Family. This is just what you expect from some raggedy landlord at some apartment complexes. But this takes on, especially in situations like this sister's in with her little kid and stuff, this takes on and plays out that genocidal impulse that we went in specifically in Hurricane Sam series number 5. Now here we're going to go into a report that was on CNN on FEMA talking about cutting the services for people who have the hotel bills and who are of course victims once again of Hurricane Sam and all of its elements, and some talk by some Jai Time FEMA officials along with New York officials. So let's check this out, as once again this helps explore how New Orleans is the classroom for Black America. Check it.
Seven days from now, FEMA will stop paying hotel bills for most of them. With just 2 weeks' notice, many face the real possibility of returning to a shelter or even living on the street. That's the extreme. I'll talk to a Katrina evacuee in a moment, as well as a state social worker from Louisiana. First, some background. Here's CNN's Jason Carroll in New York.
Justin. This morning, Quentin Garris took time to play with his kids, 9-month-old Justice and 2-year-old Zaria. For the family, a brief moment of happiness before harsh reality sets in.
We frustrated, angry, tired, disgusted, disappointed, just ready to settle down.
Since if this family of four, forced from their New Orleans home by Hurricane Katrina, has been living in a New York hotel room, temporary housing, paid for by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The family's funds are running low. They've been unable to find work or affordable permanent housing in a city where the average cost of a one-bedroom apartment is more than $1,000 a month. They say FEMA has done little to help.
FEMA never came here and said, well, this is what we're doing for you all. This is housing, and you could go here, and they're going to have this and that for you.
Now FEMA says as of December 1st, it will stop paying hotel bills for Quentin and some 51,000 other evacuees living in hotels across the country.
I can't imagine being homeless all of a sudden with 2 children. On the 1st, all my things are going to be put out on the street.
We don't know what to do at this point because we keep getting pending.
On Friday, a room full of evacuees living in New York hotels face FEMA and city officials.
I'm here to tell you what the reality is. I'm the messenger.
Danielle West, hope to hear something encouraging, but most of what she listened to were complaints from others just like her.
I have not received a check. I have not received any assistance whatsoever from FEMA.
But if they've told you that there's a check that's been sent, that in a way is good news because that means you're eligible. And we need to find that check.
December 1st date was not told to us. Okay, we found that out through rumor.
Then some encouraging words. New York City officials say the city would pick up the tab and allow evacuees, under certain conditions, to stay in hotels until January 1st. But then the city representative said something no one wanted to hear.
But the shelter system is an available resource.
Critics say some of the city shelters are so unsafe, even the homeless won't stay there. West had enough.
I never been home. It's a damn game. I like to go to the shelter. I can go to the shelter.
West was too upset to talk with us after that. FEMA's representative didn't want to talk either.
Why, at this point, are we still hearing the same kind of complaints we heard several weeks ago, more than a month ago? Why are we still here?
Late Friday, New York City's mayor sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees FEMA, asking them to extend hotel funding and consider postponing the deadline. Despite the city's efforts, many here aren't sure what their futures now hold or who they can turn to for help. Jason Carroll, CNN, New York.
Now, once again, like we went over in the Hurricane Sam series number 4, FEMA, the beast has landed. This makes it clear that FEMA is operating within the political, social, economic, martialized construct of the beast state apparatus, and that this is about social control. From all the psyops and all this stuff and cutting lines of communications and kicking people to the side who wanted the aid, to now, all of a sudden, giving notice that they're going to cut people off, people not getting checks that they were, quote unquote, claimed they're supposed to get from FEMA. And look at how New York is acting. Some raggedy person coming up talking about you may consider the shelter, going to a shelter. Now, as we went over in Hurricane Sam 5, this whole shelter system was created after the construct and development and deployment of spatial deconcentration against black people and black communities to disperse black people out of their urban centers in strong masses and stuff to weaken the population as a whole and to drive many as a result into a form of homelessness. And then that's how the whole shelter system developed. And understanding that whole apparatus is also part of a genocidal tool, because these homeless shelters, many people get sick, your chances of survival goes down greatly being in those types of institutions, etc., etc. Once again, the other week, a couple of weeks ago, I did the show on the eulogy of the civil rights Negroes. One of them was Al Sharpton, who was up on the podium, you know, during Rosa's funeral, and he was crowing about how Jim Crow has sons, James Crow Esquires, and stuff like that. Well, as I mentioned, he was right about that, but being the hypocrite he is, they don't do anything about it, because here's part of a James Crow Esquire apparatus linked with institutionalized barbarity, savagery, and racism in the form of FEMA and all the whole state apparatus that's unleashing its deadly Hurricane Sam winds on the residents and of New Orleans, the internally displaced persons. And that brings up another thing. These are internally displaced persons. Under international law, they're not even supposed to worry about food, housing, and shelter, and they're supposed to have the first right back into the places that they've been displaced from. But since this is just a savage, lawless land, to hell with all of that type of stuff. This is how this is why, in essence, this is a duel to the death. It's either us or Sam. No playing games, no illusions, no thinking that you're going to be able to vote your way out or celebritize your way out, you know, be some little minstrel rapper or some junk or some, you know, coon running up and down the football field or whatever, basketball. Enough. It's this raw what they're doing. And we have to get raw back against this machine or perish. Now, CNN host in Atlanta interviews this other sister named Carlonda, and they go into the con game that the FEMA beast apparatus is grinding over the lives of the people of New Orleans through. So check this out.
Well, Katrina evacuee Carlonda Isaac joins me here in Atlanta. She is a mother of four children, including 2-year-old twins. Since the hurricane, her family has moved to at least 7 towns across 3 states. Good to see you, Carlonda. We're talking about you first evacuated from the New Orleans area to Baton Rouge. Then you ended up in Texas from various cities and then made your way to Georgia here in Atlanta. You've really been moving around a lot. Your story is very common. A lot of evacuees have been having to go to a lot of different cities to find temporary housing. You've been here in Atlanta for about how long, and where are you staying, in a hotel or with friends?
I've been here for about a month, and I have an apartment now in Lawrenceville, Georgia. We were told that we had to be out of the hotel on November the 23rd, so we moved out and found an apartment.
And you got that notice, but very short notice. Here
right.
We are right before the Thanksgiving holiday. You thought perhaps you'd be staying in the hotel for a bit longer.
Right.
And now you have eventually found temporary housing, but you still will be needing some assistance from FEMA for that. Will you be getting it?
I'm not sure. I'm talking to FEMA every day, and FEMA is unsure of what happens next. So we basically don't know what's going on and what's the next surprise.
Why has this been so difficult to get answers? How hard has it been to get some sort of straight guidance from FEMA or any other relief agency, if not the government relief agency, then perhaps other agencies like Red Cross, non-government agencies, Red Cross, etc.
Everything changes on? From day to day.
What do you mean?
I have been to every agency in Houston. I have been to every agency in Georgia. And promises that this assistance would be available for me. For rental, for clothing, gas assistance, nothing has been stable. Everything has changed. We went into some United Way funding agencies. These agencies are saying that you have to have a job in order to be assisted. In other words, they won't pay your rent unless you can show that you have income coming in.
And the difficulty has been for you and a lot of other people trying to find a job when you don't have any kind of permanent housing.
Right.
When you apply for a job, and so that's one strike against you, isn't
right.
it?
Right. I mean, if I'm going to be in East Point this week, and next
Atlanta.
Week in Marietta, and then the week after in Norcross, I don't know where I should apply for a job at. The next thing is schooling. Schooling is impossible for the kids if you're traveling from area to area in hotels.
And you have 4 kids. We talked about you have the 2-year-old twins, but you also have school-age kids, ages
right.
8 and 14.
Correct.
How have they been handling all of this? What do you tell your kids when you have to pack up and move from place to place?
I don't give them promises, but I tell them it's going to get better. It's going to get better. They're in school now.
And do even you believe that it is going to get better? Given the fact that you're not able to get the kind of straight answers you've been needing in the past 2 months?
FEMA's not going to do anything more for us. I think that the system has failed us. Totally failed us, and I see that they are getting out of the promises and they are backing up from this disaster and moving on to other things now.
Is that your feeling because, you know, you're one of something like 53,000 people from Texas, Louisiana, folks in Georgia, Mississippi, who are living in temporary housing, mostly hotels as a result of Katrina and Rita. Do you feel like the system is just overwhelmed, didn't know what to do with the volume of people who are needing housing, or is it your feeling that it is just what FEMA says? We're out of money. We just don't have the funding anymore.
FEMA, along with Red Cross, along with other agencies, has misappropriated funds.
enough money was donated, enough funds were distributed by FEMA in order to provide for every household in New Orleans. Louisiana, New Orleans, that metro area is very small. $465 million as of October the 3rd has been directed towards hotel lodging. That was enough money to house every evacuee for a six-month period.
And just for the record, we have requested that FEMA come on this program to help spell out exactly what is at issue, and has there been enough money allocated, and has it been appropriated, and we really don't know the answers because they have denied our request to come on this program just for the sake of fairness. Meantime, I also hear from you, not only are you frustrated, but you are feeling quite angry, aren't you, that you and others were let down from the government that you thought might be able to help you in a situation like this?
Right, that's why I pay taxes. I'm 32. I've been paying taxes for 12 years. And I pay taxes just to set aside for situations like this. That's what the IRS is for. And it has definitely failed us. And even if we're not dependent on FEMA, people, celebrities, citizens, churches have come together and donated money to Red Cross. Red Cross has not halfway distributed that money. FEMA has distributed money to United Way. United Way has not given us the money that we need to start over.
And so now, Carlinda, meantime, you are in temporary housing here in the Atlanta area in an apartment. How are you going to continue to pay rent? You haven't been able to find the job because of the obstacles that you just expressed.
Right. Right.
What are you going to do? Can you look beyond this week?
No, I tell you that I can't. The only thing that I can do is continue to be resourceful. I can continue to use the skills that I have in trying to locate a job, and I can just pray.
All right, Carlinda, Isaac, thanks so much, and best of luck to you and your four kids here in the Atlanta area, and hope that you're able to find that kind of permanent employment so that you can then get that permanent housing. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Once again, this helps expose. This sister's been in seven different towns, three states, since the Hurricane Sam episode invaded into her life. This is ridiculous. There's no way in hell that this is some accident. And as even the CNN host acknowledged, that this is common. So the obvious disruption of people's lives that keeps happening. This is a week by week, day by day, month by month grinding episode. So FEMA and the so-called governmental relief organizations, these are just Orwellian terms. FEMA and the Red Cross, they're not relief organizations. They're part of the state apparatus, and FEMA is part of the beast apparatus with all of, well, let's check out Hurricane Sam 4. We don't have time for me to go all into this. But some of the powers that they have is clear within their own documents. And it has nothing to do with protecting people's rights or helping people survive the storm. They are the brown shirt storm. So once again, you have a sister who is intelligent and knows things are being misappropriated and swindled and stuff like that. But it's just the whole odds. And this is why it's so crucial for us to collaborate against this savage system. Because if we're just scattered out into the wind, they'll just rip us apart. They'll rip us, or they'll continue to rip us apart. And here you have a situation where FEMA, here they're still down in New Orleans with this ridiculously expensive setup that they have there, just for them, while people are squandering and trying to survive, not only in New Orleans, but all over the damn country. And they're disengaging even more from the population. And your disengagement is in alignment with the attention and intensity that they're being scrutinized. We know that they're not going to be scrutinized all that tough by the whole state and corporate media apparatus on a day-by-day basis. That's why it's up to us to go beyond our illusions about them and take matters in our own hands. Now, part of the reason why I slap these little athletes, entertainers, and all this stuff around is because when you see these coons still donating to Red Cross and these various other agencies and stuff and holding on to their illusions to them and promoting, you know, things for Red Cross, they're just playing right into the hand in confusion. This money goes down a psyops hole because these institutions are not about the aid of our people. They're about crushing our people and help set up what the old line elites, the corporations, and the state apparatus has in store, which is basically no future for us. So this game of being lost in space has to come to an end. And supporting, you know, independent grassroots entities like Pastors for Peace and stuff like that is what is essential. Now, this last clip I'm going to throw down on is this brother Lionel. He's with Bring Back New Orleans, who sums up the scam that Nagin and his old line white master family from New Orleans have in store, along with the corporate structure and the FEMAs and all of that. Now, they were at this meeting, this housing and subcommittee meeting, urban plan thing, that Nagin helped set up, along with one of his little buddies, this real estate thug named Joe Canziaro. But at the end of the day, let's check out what Lionel has to say as the reality of what our enemies are doing and what we need to do and how we need to refocus what we perceive as real and unreal takes place. Check it out.
And I could be wrong on this, but I think that we're going to have a continuous problem here. Whenever you want to understand the principle of where something is going, and it's been written, you have to look at the principle of the person who wrote it. And, you know, we can go round and round in here, but if you give me something of substance to read, I want to know the history of the person who wrote it. And if the history of the persons who wrote it is not in accordance to what it's supposed to be, then you're going to have a play on words here. And what I'm listening to is the co-chairs or whatever the term is when we're creating all these terms, which is, it needs to be demystified because it's BS. We need to go straight to the point, lay it out, what it needs to happen, how it needs to happen, because all over the country, as the brother just said, we've been looked at. And I don't think that the people who wrote that, these 13 principles or 12 principles, they have a track record of taking care of business the way it should be taken care of. Let me finish, Tamisha. Let me finish. All I'm saying to you is, we need to be conscious and not sit in here and be drunk about who the writers are. All right?
Part of consciousness and part of self-determination is for us to stand up. So right now, can we change the conversation? What do we want this principle to say? What do we want? Let me get to the real question. As Lionel put it so eloquently, let's stop bullshitting around this. How do we feel we can create a structure to eliminate poverty.
Tamisha, what I'm saying
Let's discuss
how these guys,
that.
How these guys get to be the authors of something, the people who should be the authors of some of the people in here, then we won't have to go through the bullshit, because we're going through bullshit now. They write something, we got to come back and go line by line. Listen to me, word by word, change it out. If you're talking about bullshit, that's bullshit.
Right.
If you want to eliminate the bullshit, don't start the bullshit, then we won't have to eliminate it. Let's go straight to the top. Come on, man. Don't stand up there. Don't, listen to me, shit. I ain't for the bullshit. All right, I stood in that hive. I watched them people come out that dome, and it's sinister. All right? It's sinister. My family was out. I stood in this city 26 days. And let me tell you something. I'm 53 years old. I've been on the ground since 13. And it's criminal for the amount of poverty that we took out that dome. Not to even mention the convention center. It's criminal for the lack of planning. It's criminal how the whole thing went down. When you see women shitting and pissing on themselves and coming out there with their periods down, and children coming out walking between military people looking into the staircase with nobody to receive them, and all we can do is take them and put them on the bus. Don't you stand up there and tell me about bullshit. The folk who you read from, that's bullshit. Let's take the meat to them. We don't need them to create this. They're creating it because they have money. They're creating it because they have power. They're creating it because they have their way. Don't tell me about bullshit. Have them to use it as a suppository. Don't bring me some shit. Then I gotta rewrite it. What's it bullshit? We got people spread out like dust. And we sitting here going over something somebody else done already wrote. What's the point? And the real players are in this room. Not those guys. They sit at the top because they have money and authority. But let me tell you something. Whatever happens here, New Orleans has become the classroom of America. Alright? Whatever happens in New Orleans, so goes America. And whatever happens to the African-American community in New Orleans, so goes the African-American community in America. And the African-Americans across the country, including the Africans, including the whites, everybody's paying attention to just how foolish of a people we are. So I don't want to hear nobody tell me about bullshit. It's bullshit for somebody to write something, give it to us, and then we got to dissect it, and we got to assume what they say. That's a gross waste of our time. Why the hell they not here? What they doing that's so important? They wrote it. Let them sit here and explain what their interpretation is like the Bible. We can read it and then everybody walked out of here with a different interpretation. So we're sitting here. Well, what do that mean? Well, what did that say? Well, why did they write this? Well, we bullshit. And we let them bullshit us. We don't need them to write that for us. We're the practitioners on the ground every day. The race is won by the crew in the pit, not the driver. The people in this room is the crew in the pit. Don't bullshit yourself.
Exactly. No more games. No more illusions. Understand these are enemies. New Orleans is the classroom for black folks in America. And South America. These ruling order thugs are the principals within these schools. And they have it set up for us to fail. We have to delegitimize their schooling apparatus. Because the classrooms that they have us in is designed for our own destruction. These are enemies. And those who align themselves within this structure, no matter what so-called good intentions or illusions that they have, are playing within the confines and structures of our enemies, consciously or not. And we don't have time to fail anymore in the classroom of America. Either we go or Sam goes. This is to the death. And our tradition says slave revolt to the end. Well, let's slave revolt against this enemy and put this enemy at its end. Next time, slave out.